This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to Lama Surya Das's Awakening Now podcast. We are very pleased to share with you Lama's unique illumination of the Awakened Awareness teachings. If you are interested in supporting Lama Surya Das's podcast, please go to beherenownetwork.com/Suryadas.
So we've been practicing the view, meditation, and non-action of the great perfection, or Dzogchen, the luminous great consummation, in the form of Tregchud, or seeing through, being through, literally cutting through, Tregchud, cutting to pieces, cutting through solidity, cutting through the illusion of separateness, cutting through the separation between self and others, between oneself and the world, etc., or between oneself and one's true self, or Buddha-ness, the being, transpersonal being. Bridging that gap, seeing through, cutting through, or just being through. It's the main practice of Dzogchen, Tregchud in Tibetan. There are many ways of translating it, as I said. Cutting through, seeing through, being through, as I like to call it. Natural meditation, non-meditation, etc. Because it's not just mental calisthenics or trying to improve our mind with a small M, our conceptual mind, our intellect, our intelligence or IQ, but includes all the Qs, EQ, emotional intelligence, spiritual intelligence, existential intelligence, psychic intelligence, somatic intelligence, spatial intelligence, and so on. Not just the intelligence of the intellect, IQ. It nourishes or actualizes and activates both sides of our brain, if you want to talk neurodharma, neuroscience, as it's becoming so popular today in our scientistic, secular society. Tregchud, seeing through, being through. In the form of sky gazing, Namkhai Naljur, sky space union yoga, as I introduced today, with eyes open, everything open, not closed, not in, going inside, as some call it in the meditation traditions, not visualizing or looking for anything, not breath counting or concentrating on the breath even, but naked awareness practice, sky gazing, space mingling, infinite dissolving or resolved in the openness, the voidness, the intersubjectivity beyond reference points, beyond conceptual notions, beyond names and forms. Sky gazing is my term for it. Namkhai Naljur, sky space union yoga, merging with the infinite. In no way leaving out the notion of the one in the infinite, or the divine, or whatever you call her or it, the higher power, deeper power, the ultimate. A way of returning home to oneself with a capital S in the middle of the word, to the oneness, to see through the illusion of separateness or duality. recognizing interconnectedness, interdependent origination, interwovenness, interbeing, as the great Zen master of Vietnam, Thich Nhat Hanh, coined it, interbeing, interwovenness. So it's a wonderful, joyous light practice, not just of the mind, but of the spirit of awareness, of the spirit of pure presence, primordial presence, who and what we truly are, not just what we become as we grow up and are socialized and form a personality and an ego and a character structure and a mentality, and we, you know, fill the hard disk of our brain, the left brain, with information. There's such a big difference between this kind of Gnostic knowing we're talking about here, Gnostic awareness or direct, quote, knowing, intuitive knowing or grokking. Big difference between that and mere information or intellectual knowledge. So we've talked about the view, meditation, and action of the great perfection swooping down from above, beginning from the Buddha-ness, from the view, from the bigger picture, the great perfection, so-called, beyond perfect and imperfect, Maha-ati, as Sanskrit scholar Chögyam Trungpa used to call it. Dzogchen is in Sanskrit, Maha-ati, Maha-dzogpa, beyond big and small, great, ultimate, total. The view of everything perfect and fine, complete, a lawful unfolding, just as it is, beyond notions of good and bad, right or wrong, mine or others, is us and them, etc., and all the proliferating problems that come from that dualistic, bifurcating thinking. The view where there's nothing to do but enjoy the view, leading to the meditation of non-meditation, not just mental calisthenics, not just trying to calm and clear our mind or get any special state of mind, not just trying to be happy, happiness and sadness or like emotional roller coaster, but be more wellness, content, in harmony, flow, beyond the vagaries of experience and emotions, the ups and downs of ordinary life. Of course, including them, but not being totally limited to that, not being so affected by it, being more centered or more in the flow, more resilient, more content, more detached, even if that's not too cold for you, a word, more equanimous, equanimity, equanimous, to use the Buddhist term, like the grandparents are more equanimous about the children than the parents, who are still more invested in and attached to them. And have more responsibility for them too. Therefore, care more. But the bigger picture, the view, the longer run, the eagle's eye view, the view from above that see things as they are and how it all fits together. Not needing to put everything in its place. Maybe wherever it lands is the right place. Not trying to keep all your balls in the air either. As Buddha sort of said, perhaps maybe loose translation of what he meant, everything is already perfectly at rest and at peace, which doesn't mean static, but ecstatic, flow, a lawful unfolding. That's the meaning of samsara and nirvana, inseparable. As somebody said yesterday, just finger painting and shorthand, that nirvana is right here and now. Not elsewhere, not after we die, not in the West, as some prayers have it, in the Western Buddha field, beyond the sunset and all that. That's poetry. There's no directionality in the ultimate. There's no gender in the ultimate. There's no time, divine time, the timeless time, as we call it in Dzogchen, the fourth time beyond past, present, and future, linear, conventional time, sequential time, the fourth time, the timeless time, the now. It's beyond time, beyond direction. It's the center, it's the circle, all-inclusive, whose circumference is nowhere and center everywhere. So the view, like the sky, open, without corners, without outside and inside, all-inclusive, the bigger frame that includes the entire picture, leading to the meditation of non-meditation, not just mental calisthenics, visualizing, trying to get in a likable state of mind and stay in it, like fighting for a better berth on the Titanic or repainting or redecorating your prison cell. So limited. The view leading to the meditation, naturally, of non-meditation, inseparable from, not emphasizing crossing your legs, closing your eyes, length and duration, how many mantras or prayers or bows you say, make, or offer, etc. But quality, not quantity, the quality of presence, awareness with a capital A, Buddha mind, as the Zen people call it, mind with a capital M, heart mind, not just intellect with a small M, mind. The meditation of non-meditation, of pure presence, of presencing, as I call it, because it's a verb, awaring. Being, cutting through means seeing through, being through, just being through, truly. Not just getting from here to there over many lifetimes, as it says in the general progressive developmental teachings of religions, including Buddhism, but getting from here to here, totally and completely here, uber here, as we say in the non-dual direct access enlightenment now, one-step enlightenment teachings of Mahamudra, Tantra Mahamudra and Dzogchen. The view, the meditation, inseparable, and naturally the proactive Buddha activity comes from that. We'll talk about that more at the end of the week as we prepare to go back to our daily lives, the virtues and the activities of the Bodhisattva and so on. Action. But action is here too, view, meditation, and action inseparable. We're doing something, we're sitting and meditating, we're having a meditating period, we're walking, we're eating, we're talking, we're learning with some, you know, et cetera. We're experiencing. So view, meditation, and action always go together. We're not quietists. We're not trying to avoid action. Doing nothing is just one more ego strategy to try to make yourself happy or something. Thus, the Zen slogan, Wu Wei, non-doing or non-striving, which in Tibetan is Jha Drel, beyond action than inaction. The Dzogchen master, Patro Rinpoche, always used to say this, beyond action and inaction. Beyond action and beyond inaction, the sublime Dharma is accomplished. Ooh, electrifying. Then what? What do I do? Or undo? Even undoing seems like too much. Cruel and unusual practices. What to do? That's the koan. To chew on till your teeth fall out, till your jaw falls off, your head falls off. Then you'll know what to do. There's a whole book about this. It's a very ancient, great tantric text. It's called On Having No Head by Douglas Harding, a real 60s classic. In fact, the cover shows a person, and there's a hole in the cover where the head would be. And his entire enlightenment was that he didn't need his head anymore. He was a very learned British guy in the spiritual traditions. That his head was just a big meatball stuffed with noodles and spaghetti, red spaghetti sauce. Or as I put it, swish, on having no head. It's a great teaching. It's right up there with Zen and the Art of Archery, Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, and some of the other spiritual classics of the 60s, which seemed like they were yesterday to some of us. But still recommendable reading. Beyond action and inaction. So then what? What do we do? What is the Dzogchen meditation? That's why we stress the view, not the meditation, not how long we sit, not the religion of sitting, as I call it. What about standing? What about walking? Not to mention talking and many other different forms of life activity. The view enhances every activity, every practice. View, meditation, and action inseparable. That's the practice of the great perfection of Dzogchen. Dancing with life. Not worrying about it if we know how the steps. Enjoying the music and moving to it. what do they say? In the Dzogchen tradition, dancing as if no one's watching, including oneself, dancing until there's no dance and dancer, there's just the dancing. So we've been practicing. I introduced today the sky gazing. Again, these are the instructions. Eyes open, ears open, nose open, and everything else open. And it's worth going through it. Chest open, diaphragm open, anus open, breath open, not intentional, you know, breath of fire or holding breath or anything else. Not breath watching, not breath counting like in some concentration practices. Sky gazing, space, infinite space, union yoga. Seeing through, enjoying all the floats that go by on the Easter parade of awareness. Not just the pretty Hawaiian floats, but also the scary Battle of Stalingrad floats or Horror House. I guess today we should say Walking Dead zombie floats. How cool is that? Everybody loves those things now because it's entertaining. Don't bother your mind and it won't bother you. That's the promise. Embodied in the many teachings of letting go, letting be, equanimity, non-attachment, seeing through, recognizing impermanent phenomena, just rolling on, ownerless, selfless, impermanent phenomena, rolling on. Wherever you look in the nine jhanas, in the 84,000 teachings of Buddha, it's the same emphasis, it's the same intent, it's the same wisdom mind pointing, introducing, directing, pointing out instructions, how to be, how to see this world. What did we hear yesterday from the professor corner over here? The Diamond Sutra purportedly says, I don't know, I haven't read it lately, all you need to study or all you need to teach is the four-line verses, see this world like a dream, like a fantasy, like a mirage, like echoes, like rainbows in the sky, like bubbles passing on a fast-moving stream or a waterfall, like dewdrops evaporating on blades of grass at dawn, like a sitcom, like a movie. Did I get most of them? Like a dream is really all we need to think. Not that it is a dream. There's still difference between daydream life and night dream, between good dreams and nightmares, to be distinguished in the relative reality that we abide in. But at the same time, not losing fact that it's just a dream, like the wise parent. When the child's screaming from their bedroom in their dream, they're being, whatever, attacked by a tiger or something. The parent knows if they wake up, there's no tiger. They don't go and look for their tiger gun that they have in the closet to shoot intruders. The parent, the wise elder, recognizes it's just a dream. There's no tiger attacking anybody. Of course, they might very well take it seriously enough to go to the child's room, soothe the child. The child's crying, sweating, tearing at their pajamas, and so on. You try to soothe them, whether they're awake or asleep. Of course, you take it that seriously, but not extra seriously. You don't believe in the tiger. That's the difference, recognizing the ultimate nature of things while dealing with the relative nature of things. That's the great middle way philosophy of Mahayana Buddhism, balancing the absolute shunyata, voidness, subjectivity, emptiness, with the relative karma, interconnectedness, compassion, discriminating awareness, and so on, how things work. The difference between food and poison, medicine and poison, etc. So, swooping from above with the view while climbing up from below through relative practices according to our capacity. Here, of course, we're having a meditation retreat. We're not just doing nothing. Although it may not look like much, a lot's happening, as you can attest since you're watching your minds. There sure is a lot happening, not to mention what else is going on. How we relate to it, what we make of it, makes all the difference. So this practice helps us to embrace the bigger picture and appreciate everything as it is, not just always be involved with sorting and liking and disliking and choosing and our ideas and concepts and beliefs and history, our story, our miserable childhood, or whatever story we carry around, our victimhood, our this, our that, our not good enough, our poor, you know, whatever. I'm just a woman, I can't become president. I'm just a black, I can't become president. I don't know why you'd want to become president today. Oprah would be crazy to become president. But whatever you think, in short, your story. Just one more story. Of course, it's an important one. It's for you to attend to and be aware of, but factor in. It's not the whole story. There are other perspectives. There are other people even. Who knew? Not to mention other kinds of beings, not just people, not just white people. Look around the room. There are other kinds of people. Who knew? There are other ways of living. There are other ways of seeing things. There are other religions. Who knew? They don't tell you that when you're growing up, usually. So this practice helps loosen all that up, and then we get to choose more choicefully our life, our attitude, and our actions. We find freedom and autonomy within interconnectedness, not just teenage independence, but autonomy within interconnectedness. So view meditation action inseparable. So now if we talk more specifically about the Dzogchen meditation of non-meditation, of innate wakefulness, not concentration, not visualizing, not chanting, not radiating lights, not healing, not praying for peace or praying for help. The view, the bigger picture, everything. I hate to say perfect, everything as it is. How about that? Gorgeous. Or just as it is. See how it's so hard to not get caught in associations and value judgments. The great consummation, the bigger picture, the ultimate sphere. The view as it is. Leading to the meditation of getting used to as it isness. Leaving it as it is, not just sitting, crossing your legs, and hoping to get enlightened. In Tibetan, the word for meditation is gom. Getting used to it, or maturation. Maturing what? Maturing the view, stabilizing the view. The naked awareness, the presencing. Not the discriminating awareness that can choose this over that and have good judgment and value judgments. That's more relative intelligence and wisdom. So from the view of how it is, as it is, the natural great perfection or completeness or lawfulness, the luminosity, the radiance of things just as they present themselves, as they are, comes the meditation of non-meditation, getting used to leaving it as it is, seeing it as it is, right, leaving it as it is. And third, naturally being what is as needed, what's called for. Not coming with your preconceived notions, like the cookie cutter model of parenting or of mentoring or of educating people, turning them all out on a production line. Not coming with your own agenda and obsessions all and drivenness all the time, but if something's needed, then responding. So proactive Buddha activity, not ego-based karmic reactivity. Proactive mood activity. So the view and the non-meditation, leaving it as it is, naturally leads to the spontaneous compassion or unobstructed responsiveness of the great perfection. Not inert, not static, not cold and detached, not mistaking equanimity or spiritual detachment or one taste equanimity, not mistaking that for indifference and complacence, which is quite different. It's like the grandparents are not indifferent or complacent, but they're more equanimous and detached than the parents, who are naturally more involved, responsible, and therefore attached to outcomes regarding their children. the grandparents have been through it all. So that's the elder space, a bigger view that we're talking about inhabiting in this practice. There are other parts of our practice of cultivating compassion, virtue, helpfulness, altruism, generosity, and all the other bodhisattva virtues, values are much emphasized. When we're practicing a tregchud, seeing through, being through, again, the view like the sky, eyes open, mind open, heart open, everything open, the view like the sky, not looking inside for a Buddha or for anything, not looking outside for anything, not sky worshiping, not cloud analyzing, the view open like the sky, just at ease, just open, gazing, like on a hill overlooking the ocean and the horizon, not counting the waves, analyzing the clouds, waiting for your ship to come in, not sky gazing, view like the sky, and second, meditation, non-meditation, like a mountain, unchanged, no matter what grows on it or falls on it, like a mountain. Grounded, like a pyramid, a mountain. View like the sky, meditation like a mountain. And naturally precedes action, like inexhaustible, like the ocean's waves. View meditation and action resulting in the natural, the innate, great perfection. Dzogchen. So I think that's a good key to remember as we're practicing. View like the sky and eyes open kind of metaphorically embodies that, and spacious, not looking up, straining your neck or your eyes, just like gazing, not looking down, trying to concentrate with room for everything, sights, sounds, physical sensations, emotions, everything. Like the sky, that can include all the weather and all the planes and all the birds and everything else. And spacious, like the sky, really means like space, like deep space, not just the local sky. And meditation like the mountain, just vast, just huge, just one taste, unchanging, imperturbable maybe is the word. Not locked in, not fixed, not numb, but imperturbable is a difference. Not controlling, the mountain's not controlling, the mountain doesn't have to. Imperturbable, no matter what falls on it, no matter what grows on it. Grounded, vast, and inexhaustible like the ocean's waves. View meditation action like a resultant, the great perfection. Three in one, inseparable, like three in one oil, not even in sequence. The view enhances every relative practice or just every action in life, even brushing your teeth. As Thich Nhat Hanh famously said, one of the introducers of mindfulness to the bigger world, washing dishes in the sunlight of awareness is enlightenment practice. Not hurrying with the dishes, not bothering to wait for hot water and just throwing them, you know, into the drying rack. Or I mean, you modern people, you may have dishwashers or I don't know what, microwaves, but washing dishes is the practice, not hurrying through that so you can get to your meditation room, sit and try not to think. I won't name any names. Not just dishes, because we all love food. Also diaper shit, shoveling the snow, whatever, doing what has to be done, going to work, doing what has to be done in the sunlight of awareness. That's enlightenment practice. That's the awakened life style, as it were. To complete this tirade, and because Vipassana man is sitting right in front of me thinking about Vipassana and Dzogchen and how this is not or is like a Vipassana retreat. And I'm sure you remember Vipassana boy, that Buddha said there were four main positions for cultivating mindfulness. He didn't use the word meditation because he didn't speak English. Buddha, maybe you're familiar. He probably spoke Pali or Prakrit or some very ancient language. Anyway, he said there were four, he called it cultivating mindfulness. That was his teaching. He said there were four main positions. Sitting, of course, that's obvious. Anybody remember the others? Vipassana boy? Standing, that's a good one. Walking, and what's the fourth? Lying down. That pretty much covers it. Of course, if he was alive today, he might include a few others, you know, like jogging, swatting, I don't know what, swimming, thumbing. Thumbing used to mean something else, but you know what I'm talking about, thumbing. Or in my case, fat fingering. Maybe some of you receive my typo texts. In other words, what is the point? Every posture is the posture for cultivating mindfulness. Again, the view enhances every practice and everything we do. And that's how we integrate the Dharma into daily life, into every creek, every nook and cranny of daily life. Not just the peak experiences and retreats or in pilgrimages and caves and mountaintops and deserts and holy lands. Not just at retreats, you know, once a year, once a month, once a season, whenever you come. Not just on your meditation cushion or yoga mat in the morning or a couple times a week at the yoga studio. But there's the rest of the day, the rest of the week to account for. Mingling spirit and life. They're inseparable anyway. We're really the ones that see it as separate. Integrating Dharma into daily life, that's where the rubber really meets the road on the spiritual path. Every day. Being a backyard bodhisattva. Being a mother or father bodhisattva. Being a doctor, healer, bodhisattva. Not just a business, not just a selfish, you know, person in the helping professions. Or whatever. But we don't even have to be in helping professions. I think we should be like Mother Teresa. Everything we do is part of it, can be part of it. See this world like an altar and all the beings, including ourselves, like the deities on it. Pure perception, sacred outlook, sacramental vision. It's a great practice for daily life. Any questions, please, or sharing? Marvin, how are you today, my dear friend? Good.
Lama Sure, let me just say, well, I don't have the words to adequately say what I want to say. However, I'm going to try real briefly. Lama Surya gave a weekend retreat in Wilmington, North Carolina, little Wilmington, North Carolina of 100,000 people or so in September. And when I was going to introduce Lama Surya, he asked me what I was going to say. And I talked about some of his past masters, so on and so forth. He just shook his head.
Go on. We're all listening intently.
He said, "Tell them why you're my student." Well, they had to move me off the stage, really, because there wasn't enough time to really tell them why. There were so many things. Dr. John was there, who has been a student of Lama Surya's probably 20 years, and I haven't been that long. Others here, like Yeshe, have been at least 20 or so years. And they're back and back and back. And Lama John and Nancy came to North Carolina for the retreat. And geez, he's probably been to dozens of retreats. Why would he come there? Well, it's pretty obvious as to why he comes there. Drew here. But anyway.
What do you do for a living, Marvin? Are you a professor or something? Or an orator?
I'm professing right now.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was a professor. I'm not irrationally exuberant. I am a mature university professor, retired administrator at a number of major research universities in the country during my lifetime, and actually spent time as a scientist in the U.S. State Department with nuclear negotiations around the world. So I'm fairly mature, and I think I know what I'm talking about here. Lama Surya, yesterday, for example, he gave the most awesome day of teachings I have ever heard in my life. I wrote down a note this morning, sitting here waiting for this to start, and it said this: after yesterday's Dharma talks, anything today has to be a letdown. Yesterday...
And now it's come true. You're also a seer.
No, let me finish. You didn't let me finish with the introduction to you in Wilmington. He just walked on the stage. But yesterday we were in the clouds. I mean, we were really in the clouds. No, IBM is not the only thing that stores things in the clouds and so forth. But we were there, and I felt like we couldn't go any higher. But today, you've heard him. He not only talked us through everything the Buddha said and told us how to do it with Dzogchen and the approach to Dzogchen, but even when we got through the meditation, the view and the meditation, and he got to action, even really explained to us how to live our lives. How we can't take that and become enlightened ourselves. I don't know, when I die, ask me, because, you know, why it didn't work, although I'm trying to make it work. But what I want to say, Lama Surya, is probably pretty obvious, but this is the most awesome. I've been coming to his retreats for years, advanced retreats in Osaling, Texas, and everyone that was offered, I think I always went. And I've never heard anything really like the last 2 days. There's one thing you said that, if I heard you correctly, it really bothers me a bit. And I listened pretty carefully, even though I don't hear that well. But you said yesterday, on this last lap, if I heard you correctly, and I think what I'm going to do is go home and every day I'm going to sing and chant the long life prayer for Lama Sutra Suya. And I
thank you, Marvin. We'll give you a gong for that.
I ask everyone to do that.
Thank you.
End of my message. Thank you Lama Surya. It's just absolutely awesome.
Thank you. It's very kind of you. Thank you. You're a beautiful bodhisattva, brother Marvin. I'm not really planning to die, or that just fell out of my mouth, because Buddha said the main, as the elephant's foot, the biggest footprint of the animals in the jungle is the elephant's, the biggest or most important meditation is to remember death, impermanence, mortality. And it's not a morbid teaching, it's a great teaching about living here and now and savoring the moment and being grateful and the miracle of life that we're given, and every day above, you know, looking at the grass from this side is a good day, as they say, etc. I don't have to tell you that. You're retired now, so, you know, it's good to think about these things. It's also good, you know, not to wait until you get enlightened, or it's good to aspire towards enlightenment, but remember that we're all in this together. We all rise and fall, sink or swim together. And I can't just be enlightened or content if our family and friends and society and world is ablaze. So let's practice being there. This is my Dzogchen slogan, being there while getting there, every step of the way, not waiting. That has nothing to do with age or duration. And questions, please.
Hi. So just now you were saying waiting to become enlightened. But yesterday we kind of said enlightenment is now. I'm missing a key piece, I don't know. But then you said being there while getting there. You're breaking it apart. You're making it two separate things rather, you know, like if enlightenment is now, then we're already there. Can you elaborate on that?
That's the ultimate view.
Which one?
That samsara and nirvana are inseparable, to quote from the scriptures. I don't want to reify your words. Enlightenment is now, but you know that's related. Are you following? Okay.
No.
So the philosophical premise or explanation is in the ultimate and the conventional have to be taken into account. So the conventional I hardly need to speak about. That's the world we live in, study and educated in. But we forget about that there's maybe another side to it. I mean, maybe there isn't. But we're introducing that there's another side to it. And it's not even another side. It's the two sides of the same hand. So it may matter which side of the hand you use, you know. I don't know. You use this side for one thing and this side for another. I don't know. Right? Mm-hmm. Or left or right. Or which side of the road you drive on might matter very much. But in the relative, it's different. In the absolute, it doesn't matter. It only matters that you drive on the right side, the correct side of the road, if you want you and your passengers to live. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So in the ultimate, it doesn't matter. It's all one. But in the relative, it matters totally. And if you don't know, you will have the total bill for not know, for that ignorance, which is death on the road. Is that clear?
I think so.
That's the meaning. It's a relative perspective. But in the ultimate, of course, there's no right and wrong which side of the road. It's very arbitrary. It's like local laws. In one country, it's illegal to I don't know what. What should I mention that won't get everybody riled up?
Nothing.
But in other countries, the same thing is legal. So that's very local. But then there are universal laws. I'm not talking about my truth or your truth, universal laws. Like, I don't know what, you know, gravity, or that human babies take a certain amount of months to gestate. Not necessarily 9 months, but definitely a certain amount. Not 100 months, not 2 months, while other animals may have a different gestation period. So universal laws of human, you know, still isn't that universal, but it, like most humans, well, like parents love their children, and animals love their children. I know there may be some exceptions. You with me? Those are more universal laws, not local man-made, usually man by men-made laws. So, yes, the general teaching, the Buddhist religion, is about a path and a goal and going from the darkness of ignorance to the light of enlightenment, like all the other traditions, a progressive path and goal. And the mystical or the non-dual or the deeper, higher, vaster part of the Buddhist religion also recognizes that the goal is not after we die or after many lives necessarily, that it is available here and now because it's beyond time or space or duration. So the samsara, the darkness, and nirvana or the light are inseparable. Just like shadows and light can be very distinguishable, but there's no such thing as shadow. There's only light and more or less of it. That's more the oneness view or the unity vision, the non-dual vision, the ultimate truth. So if we're going to talk about religions, religions like to talk about truth. So Buddhism doesn't favor that because it sounds a little dogmatic. So in Buddhism, there's two truths. There's the ultimate truth or perspective and the relative truth or perspective. In the relative, there's causation and virtue and vice and good and bad. And in the ultimate, it's very hard to say those things. There's no one to say them. Death is not bad, and so forth. In the ultimate, how can you say death is bad? Death is life. Death may even be good. You may even have to put down your beloved dog or cat. Death may be the compassionate, the kindest, the goodest option, a release for the poor cancer-ridden adult in old age, right? So it's a little too simplistic to say death is bad. Everybody knows that. So the ultimate absolute truth or perspective and the relative conventional, that's the Buddhist middle way again, beyond extremes. This is Buddhist jargon. This is Buddhist philosophy. So we're talking about everything perfect as it is, as well as it could use a little tweaking here and there in the relative sense. You, perfect as you are, Buddha by nature, and if you recognize that totally, unshakably, you are Buddha. Nobody can say, no, you're not Buddha, you're Jewish, you're a woman, you're American, you're white. I mean, idiots say that. Parochial Buddhists might say that, but, you know, it's not Buddha's teaching. You with me?
I am. Thank you. Okay. I'm very visual.
So that's
visual.
A good question.
Yeah, I'm very visual. You had me at the hand.
Well, I could have stopped there. I used to be a professor. I'm also talking to everybody, but thank you. There's no excuse for questions or sharing.
I have a question about karma. You talked a bit today about action, and you talked yesterday about the good news that the future starts now, and we do positive actions, and that has positive results, and negative actions, not so positive results. It seems to me that that's half of karma, because cause and effect, the cause produces effects, the effects become causes which produce other effects. And if we look backward, there's a whole tapestry of mm-hmm. causes and effects for at least 13.8 billion years as far as we can see back. I'm having trouble understanding how my actions are not the result of a billion causes that went before.
Is everybody listening and following? Now we're getting to the interesting, important question. Could you say that again? How is it that your actions, you use the double negative, so go slow.
Yeah, I'm having trouble, first of all, trying to imagine an effect that doesn't have a cause or something.
No, could you ask your question? It was much clearer. How is it?
How is my action not dependent on the billion causes and effects that came before and produced me and produced the situation I'm in? The kicking or kissing the child.
Yeah,
right. A billion things went into the fact that the child and I are even in the same room together.
That's right. Good thinking. So can I answer your question now? Well, we got the point. It is dependent on those. It is dependent on those. So?
So
if that's true, if it is dependent on those,
true,
then...
If that's true, how can I be
how can you be responsible?
Be punished or rewarded for right. my good or bad action.
Yes. You're right. Karma has... well, first of all, you know, since you are talking, speak very clearly, I didn't want to interrupt, or I don't really want to say, it depends what you mean by karma, because you're using it very well. Karma is said to mean cause and effect. It's said to mean causation. It's said to mean conditioning. It's said to mean action. Action or activity. I don't see any my in that, or human. There's no anthropocentric emphasis in that definition. So, how does it become your karma, my action? Why should I be punished or rewarded is a very interesting question. But maybe we need to be thinking about the word that has intruded now, the my, rather than the naughty concept of karma. All of a sudden, there's a my intruding into this question, which is very natural, which we all have, as you said. Somebody else who's more... Who puts it a different way might say, so Why does it matter what I do? If it's all so, you know, the millions of causes and the whatever number you just said, 13 billion of years of evolution or whatever you're thinking about, the universe and all race and species. The my might be the issue. How did it become your? You're right. So you are not rewarded or punished. There is only the karmic unfolding. You is the illusion. In Buddhism, it's called the me and the mine. That's the illusion of self, self-grasping. You have intruded this. Is everybody following? You don't get punished or rewarded. These actions have positive or negative results that, you know, you're calling punishment and reward. That calling them my punishment, my reward, is the self-illusion that comes with the self-story, the history, the selfing, the notion of separate self. In short, there's a bigger word for it, much bigger, called ego. It's egotistical. It doesn't mean you're not responsible. It just means that you are not, there's no you as you think of yourself. So, yes, all those millions of karmic concatenations, causes and effects, whatever you want to call them, influences, seeds, and have a big effect and bring us up to now, and we can't hardly control that, to talk a certain level of kid language. But the other side, in a way, that's the bad news. It's not really bad news. That's half the news. The other news is it all depends on what you make of it now, which we've heard before. It's not what happens to you, but what you make of it that makes all the difference. Whether you kiss or kick the kid before they go to school makes all the difference and going down the generations.
But isn't whether I kiss or kick dependent on a lot of things that happened to me? I mean,
But you included that already in your 13.8 billion years of multi-grillion karmic seeds.
And it results
again,
in a kick.
So it's not that we're questioning the you in there.
I'm taking the you out and saying it results in a kick.
Okay. If it results in a kick, yes, what's the problem?
I don't think there's a problem.
Where's the reward and punishment in that?
Well, there will be future effects from that cause.
That's right. That's karma. That's the law. Whether those are rewards or punishments or good or bad has, again, a million influences on, did the kick land? Is the kick harmful? Is it a playful, loving kick? You know, are you the guy in the movie that can't move any limb except his foot? And that's how he sends his kids to school every day. Maybe you're a one-tentacled animal. Punishment and reward are very subjective. Where's the my in this? There's a lawful unfolding. Action has a result. That's what we say about karma. And then all the subjective things that come into it. Of course, we're not saying it's the same to kick or kiss. I'm just trying to see how we intrude our humanistic, solipsistic, you know, value system, and even the notion of self. I will get punished or rewarded. So there's a million causes for every act, and actions means inner, like thoughts and intentions, not just physical words. And there's a million possible karmic outflows, quote, yet to happen. And there's a lot of intermediary factors that have to come together to make anything, like, obviously, a punishment or a reward or a good or a bad, anything. So, we're not entirely responsible for all that happened before, but we are entirely responsible for what we make of it now. But still, there's the question of what's the I in this? So you can't abnegate or abdicate whatever your responsibility, but there's also no reason to beat your chest and blame yourself for what went before. That's why redemption, turnaround, being saved is totally possible anytime in the now. That's the good news, that's the promise, that's the liberation from this. So you're shaking your head quizzically. I'm running out of time. Think about what I said. I think we had a very good and somewhat clear discussion just now. Not easy. But I want to say, the great Buddhist master, Zen master, and scholar who wrote 95 books on Zen Buddhism in the 20th century called D.T. Suzuki of Japan, who knew his stuff, who had a PhD from a university in Germany. He was Japanese. He was an international scholar. His subject was Meister Eckhart, Shunyata, and the Via Negativa of Meister Eckhart. He knew the difference and the same between Mahayana Buddhism and Meister Eckhart. This was no slouch, this height-impaired Japanese fellow. He explained karma this way at Columbia in the 1950s to his students, like Jack Kerouac, Kenneth Rexroth, Thomas Merton, Allen Ginsberg, and that bunch. He helped bring Zen Buddhism to the West, this D.T. Suzuki. He said, because people were always asking him if karma meant freedom, anything goes, or determinism. It's all scripted, as many theists would say. God, it's already scripted. God has, it's God's will or something. I don't know. Freedom and determinism are the philosophical terms. Are you with me? He said, it's the, somewhat both. It's like your elbow joint. This is the guy talking in English in Colombia. This amazing Japanese Buddhist Zen master scholar. It's like your elbow. You can move your elbow freely, but only one way. Yeah, you can move it freely, but only one way. So it's not just freedom, irresponsibility, you know, nihilism, nothing matters. What did Einstein say? God playing dice with the world? No. It's also not determinism. It's all scripted. So it's not what happens, but what we make of it that makes all the difference. We have the freedom. Of course, the we is the question. What state of consciousness is deciding, really? That's where the action is. That's why Buddhism is an inside job, working on the consciousness that decides in the moment. Because it comes down to the moment. So I hope that's helpful. Therefore, we get to decide if we have practiced any form of mindful anger management, whether we, you know, lash back out at the teenager or not in the moment. Kiss or kick is just a caricature. How do you deal with the teenager when they're screaming your kid that they hate you? Do you shout back, I hate you too, motherfucker, mofo? Practice a little mindful anger management, you have a more clear, spacious consciousness to choose how to you want to relate to and model it for your teenager. It goes a long way down the generations. Again, the many causes and the many effects. So I hope that's helpful. Thank you. Karma is one of the naughtiest subjects in Eastern thought. No doubt. That's why basic religions of all kinds, East and West, have the same, very same, similar, same moral code. Not to get lost in the extremes. You know, moral code, I don't need to explain to you. The Ten Commandments, the Five Precepts, the Sermon on the Mount. All the religions have a very same, if not entirely same moral code for the general population, which, I mean, doesn't even think about this very much often. It's very tough even for the people that do think about it. So back to, you know, like the awareness practice that we're doing, I really believe in this. Not all the philosophical hair splitting. Very important point for me. Thank you.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.